I want to update you on a couple things that relate to when you guys give, because I know many of you that not only give when the bag goes by, many of you give online, or you give stocks, or you have stuff just automatically debited every week or every month from your account to help fund this mission that we're on. And part of that goes to this village in Kenya that we partner with called Matura. If you've been around here for a while, you've heard us talk about Matura. But it's this village up on a kind of a hillside that overlooks Lake Victoria. And just this beautiful, beautiful place and this beautiful community in this remote part. And so one of the things we've worked on in the last 2 years is helping to get clean water there. They've never had clean water there in the history of Matura. And so I've shown you pictures in the past of where we've gotten the huge water containers now built, and they're finished and they're actually filled with water. And so now we're just waiting on the water purification engineers to come in and purify the water. And then Matura, for the first time in its history, will have clean water. That will be plenty for the whole village and all the surrounding areas. And it's going to be, it's a huge thing. It's going to be a game changer for them. And just radically change life there. I'm so excited about that. But and part of our commitment, too, is that we're trying to always bring holistic change. And that's part of our strategy when it comes to missions. And so we have two global initiatives. We have a local initiative here in the Durham Rescue Mission that we partner with, but two global initiatives. Again, we believe that we can do far more when we try to make an impact in a few places and try to leverage all of our resources in a few spots of the world rather than trying to give a little bit in a lot of different places. So our two global initiatives happen in Haiti and in Kenya. And part of that holistic change that we want to see happen there, another piece of that, cog that has to happen is education. And so water is one, clean water is one, education is another, and there's a few others. But in education, we've poured a lot in the last couple of years to trying to revitalize education there in Matura. When we started working with Matura, they were ranked 146 out of 146 districts in education systems there in their particular district in Kenya. And it was one of the reasons why we wanted to partner with them is because we said, you know what, our community, we run toward brokenness, and we run toward mess, and we run toward things that are hard, and we appreciate the sacred difficulty. And so we know that so many people won't pick them, or other churches wouldn't pick them, other organizations wouldn't pick that. So we will. And we know they're kind of in this remote part up on the side of this, half mountain kind of a thing, and it's tough to get to, and education's poor. So our community, let's wrap our arms around them. And so it was one of the things that attracted us to them. And so over the last couple of years, have invested a lot of money that you guys, from when you put money in here in the buckets and different kinds of things, that have really helped transform education there. And so that money has gone to help hire good teachers. It has gone to help buy books and resources for students in their studies. It's also gone to providing a hot meal for kids once a day. Because what we've learned about education there in Kenya is that if we can provide a warm meal once a day, that will bring kids to school, and it will keep them in school for the entire day versus, maybe going home where they don't have food, or if they go home maybe on a lunch break and then they have to walk 3 miles home and kind of ravage around for food someplace else to try to find, they never make it back to school. But that if we can keep them in school, education will improve. And so all of this, again, is tied together. And so they took their standardized test a few weeks ago, and for the first time ever in the history of Matura, they had several kids who tested into the national secondary schools, which are like high schools here, but you have to test into those schools to qualify in Kenya. And so for the first time ever, they had several students who tested into their national level secondary schools, and the community is just so excited, and they are so thrilled, and there's all this momentum that's come along from that, and parents wanting to get their kids in school now because they see the level of education rising, and they just recognize the huge difference that that's going to make for generations to come as they can get education at a high standard in this community. So we're really excited about that. A huge thanks to you guys for all that you're doing and pouring into that to help make that a reality. Also, many of you, one of the ways those funds come is also you can sponsor individual kids in their education program. And so many of you here already sponsor kids, but because we've had some new kids that have come to the school because parents now feel like, okay, now they used to maybe only send, if they had 8 kids, maybe one of those kids could go to school. But now they're trying to send more and more because, again, they're seeing the benefit that it can have. Some of those sponsorships have opened up. So if you're interested in you and your family maybe rallying around an individual kid that you can communicate with and talk with, on the other side of this wall are sponsorship packets, and you can check those out after service. But thank you guys, again, for just, it's awesome. And it's making a huge difference. And I want you to understand, again, when you give here, not only everything that you see that's happening here and locally in our community, but on another side of the planet, you are making a radical difference in people's lives. So also want to let you know, we've got a new environment that's coming up to help people if you want to get connected in our community, if you want to find out what next steps look like here at Cross Point, maybe you've been here for a while and are like, man, I want to connect with some people. I want to figure out how do I participate in this mission that we're on together. What's that look like? And so we're having an event called Take Part. So how do you take part in what we're doing? And it's on Sunday, April 21st. It'll happen at 11:45 and 1:30 upstairs in our edge room, which is upstairs and across the bridge. And it's going to be less than 30 minutes, but it's going to be a quick meeting that can help put some very tangible steps for you of how you can take some next steps if you're interested in that. And so there's childcare that can be provided for you. Keep it on Sunday morning so it's easy to get to. And then if you're interested, you can go to our website, click the I'm New button, and then there's a link that says Take Part. And you can register on there, and we'd love to have you be a part of that with us. So today, we are continuing our teaching series called Mark, where we are walking through everything that Jesus says in the New Testament book of Mark. And so we're going to pick up where we left off last week here, Mark chapter 6, starting with verse 1. It says, Jesus left there. Now, before we go any farther, it's always good to kind of remind ourselves, when it says there was what we talked about last Sunday, the home of Jairus. Jairus is a synagogue leader. And Jesus has gone into his home and he's raised his little daughter, this 12-year-old daughter of his who is dead, and he has raised her to life. And so he's at this home, and it says Jesus left there and went to his hometown. Now, we'll put a map on the screen so, again, we can follow where we're going. A few weeks ago, back, you know, a few chapters in Mark, Jesus was up near Capernaum, right there on the north part of the Sea of Galilee. And we read how Jesus and the disciples got in a boat. There's a huge storm, went across the Sea of Galilee. And they landed in the Decapolis area where crazy, you know, naked demon guy was running around. So hung out with him. And then it says they sailed back across the Sea of Galilee. And our best guess is that Jairus was somewhere back around Capernaum based on context there. And then it says they traveled to his hometown. And Jesus' hometown is down here in the far west corner of Nazareth. And so Nazareth, if you look at the maps, probably about 10 to 15 miles away. And some of you may think, wait a second, I thought Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Maybe you remember from Christmas songs and kind of a Christmas story. I thought it was Bethlehem, but he was born in Bethlehem, but he grew up as a child in Nazareth, which is why Jesus is often referred to, even in the scriptures, as Jesus of Nazareth. So he leaves the area near Capernaum, travels to Nazareth, and then we see this in verse 2. It says, when the Sabbath came, Jesus began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things, they asked. What's this wisdom that has been given him that he even does miracles? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. Now, when you listen to those questions at first, it doesn't sound like that those are very offensive type questions. And so all of a sudden it takes a different tone on them when it says, and they took offense at him. Now that word, they took offense at him, in the original language is a Greek word called scandalizo. And it's where, if you look at it, it's where we get our English word scandal from. And so the idea here is that the people in his hometown were scandalizing him. They were mocking him. They're like, wait a second, we grew up with this guy, Jesus. I mean, he's nothing special. He's just a carpenter. He's just a handyman. What does he think he's doing coming here as a rabbi, thinking he's some kind of special religious teacher? And what's this we hear about him doing miracles, and he's teaching in our synagogue? And so then they kind of have this offensive tone to their questions, but then they take their mocking a step further and they ask this question, isn't this Mary's son? Now, at this time in history, when a son was spoken of, typically he would always be referred to as the son of his father, regardless if his father was currently living or not, because one's family heritage or one's bloodline, which is always tracked through the father, was of utmost importance. So he would be called, for example, the son of David or the son of Judah or the son of Bill, you know, a son would, because it was a way to reference his heritage. And the only time that you would refer to someone as the son of their mother was if their father was in question, if there was some kind of suspicion around who their father was. Now, understandably, Jesus grew up surrounded by various rumors and speculations that he was an illegitimate kid. After all, I mean, think about it. His mother's explanation for being pregnant before she was married to her fiancé, Joseph, was that an angel had come and told her that a child was conceived in her womb by the Holy Spirit. So you can imagine how that story went around the hometown gossip circles. Sure, Mary. Yeah, okay. Holy Spirit. Whatever you say there, Mary. Again, in a world where bloodline was everything, understand, to reference someone by their mother's name was a blatant insult. It was calling them illegitimate. If you think of the worst phrase that someone maybe would use to call someone that in our day, that same type of label is what they would put on Jesus. It was a slap in the face. And so then notice how Jesus responds to their questions. Verse 4 says, Jesus said to them, only in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor. Now, some of you know exactly what that feels like. Now, you may not consider yourself a prophet, but you know what it's like to be labeled for years by a certain perception and then have people refuse to ever see you as anything else, even when it's been years later or decades later, even when that perception of you wasn't true, or even when you are way different than you originally were years before and people won't let that go. Others of you know what it feels like to be honored and valued by friends and by coworkers and even by mere acquaintances that in your opinion hardly know you, but then you walk into your own home and you feel completely dishonored, whether by a spouse or a parent or a child. Jesus says here, only in his own hometown, among relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor. And some of you know what that feels like. And there's a multitude of layers to why that is. But at least one of the major ones is this lost art in our culture of understanding how to show honor. Understanding what honor is and what honor isn't. And so that's what I want to spend the rest of our time doing today. I want to reflect on this idea of honor. Now, in the scriptures, the word honor is usually rooted in this idea of something having weight, of giving value to something or to someone. And in a similar way, the word dishonor in the scriptures carries this idea in the original language of treating someone or something as very common, as very ordinary, to disgrace or to insult one by the lack of value that's actually given to them. So I want to dive into this idea of honor for a few minutes. And by doing so, what I want to do is I want to try to give you a few principles that I believe that are true about honor. Principles that are just true relationally and that I hope that we can grab onto and they're helpful and encourage you to jot them down, reflect on them, think about them, because I think that they can be helpful in giving us traction in our relationships. And because all of us want that. All of us want to figure out how do we do relationships better. Jesus says you break everything down and you sum it all up. It comes down to loving God and loving people. And we've got to figure out how do we make relationships work. And so hopefully some of these principles on honor can help give you some better traction. The first one is this. It's that the level of honor you give is determined by the amount of value you perceive. That the level of honor you give is determined by the amount of value you perceive. Now, for example, if you were at my house and you saw this, and I'll put it on the screen so you can see it better. If you saw this, your likely first thought would be, well, why isn't that in the garbage? Because it's just a bunch of old plastic, dirty bags covered in dirt, and you got some string that's kind of all meshed around in it. And probably the last thing you'd want to do is say, well, okay, yeah, let me take that home, you know, and get really excited about a bunch of old plastic, dirty bags. Now, a couple years ago, my wife and I took both of our boys, who were about 9 and 7 at the time, with us to Kenya, to the village of Machura that I was just referencing a few moments ago. And every day there, my boys would play soccer with the kids and the adults in the village. And you can imagine that in a pretty remote African village, a real soccer ball is a rare item. And so what kids often do is they'll spend weeks going around trying to collect plastic bags in order to try to make a homemade soccer ball. Now, we might think that plastic bags here are something that's very common and easy to kind of grab onto, but there, plastic bags or plastic bottles are considered these rare finds and these gems that they want to hold on to. And so even when you're there, if you have a plastic water bottle with you, people will beg you for your water bottle just because it's a huge, huge deal. And so they look around for weeks and weeks trying to get these plastic bags, and they get them and they cram them all together and they get them in this tight packed thing, and then they wrap string around it and they make these homemade soccer balls. And for these kids, these homemade soccer balls become one of their most prized possessions. And so at the end of our last day there in Matura, we're walking down like this mountain, you know, big, huge hill that overlooks Lake Victoria. And we're walking back down, and there's this huge crowd of kids and adults that kind of follow you where you go, and they're walking with us, journeying us back with us to where the vehicle is. And as we get ready to get into the vehicle, then one of these boys that had hung out with my oldest son, Caden, all week long, comes up to him, and he hands him this soccer ball. And Caden looks at us, and he's kind of, you know, doesn't know what to do. And there's kind of that awkward insistence, like, no, you keep this. Like, because, you know, my son Caden has experienced that these kids don't have hardly anything. I mean, anything that we would consider, oh, they have stuff or they have toys, and knows what a big deal this is. And here's, you know, without a translator, here's this other kid trying to insist to his new friend, man, I want to give you the most generous gift I can think to give you. I want to give you this because you're important to me. And so Caden looks at us, and we're kind of in that, finally we're like, all right, yeah, and told him that it was okay. And so he says, thank you. And, you know, they do the whole guy fist bump thing, whatever, you know, and they get on the bus, and we head home. And so you can understand why in our family, this isn't just some kind of wadded up trash bags full of dirt and string. And you can understand why we went to great lengths to pack it very gently as we traveled through Africa and then back home, and why we've taken really good care of it, and we try to keep it in a place and keep it protected in our home, because it means something so deeply to us and represents so many important things. But here's the point of all that. From the moment you first saw this kind of wadded up plastic bags, nothing about the plastic bags changed. Nothing about the dirt changed. Nothing about any of that changed. The only thing that changed is your perception of it. That's the only thing that changed in terms of how you understood its value. And you have to understand, when it comes to people, the same thing is true. Very same thing is true. That the level of honor you give them is determined by the amount of value you perceive in them. In 1 Peter, it says this. It says, honor everyone. Period. There's no qualifications. There's no exemptions. Honor everyone. You see, the scriptures teach this, that they say every person, regardless of who they are, regardless of what they've done, what they believe, every person is created in the image of God. And that reality alone, that they bear God's image, gives them tremendous value, worthy of honor. But often we forget that. And we get blinded to that reality by their actions, by their words, by how they dishonor us, perhaps. We get blinded by their beliefs that differ than ours, or their political views that differ from ours. We get blinded by their past or their fractures. We rarely stop and consider the context that may have shaped them, the circumstances that may have impacted them, the wounds, the stresses, their insecurities that molded them. And we get blinded by all those kinds of things, and we start to believe that they are not worthy of honor. But we got to get this. Here's what we got to get clear. And so please hear me on this. To show honor does not mean that you have to be close friends with someone. To show honor does not mean that you have to trust them. Please hear me on that, because honor and trust are different things. Honor and trust are not the same things. To show honor, it doesn't mean that at times it's not a very wise thing to do to put certain boundaries in place relationally. To show honor does not mean that you have to agree with them or to approve of their choices and decisions. But what it does mean to show honor is that you treat them and speak to them and speak of them with a sense of dignity and respect. That when you have a chance to voice your opinion of someone, whether in person or whether it's in an email or whether you're talking about someone on Facebook or Twitter or wherever it is, that you would treat them and honor them as a person with tremendous value, whether you know them personally or not. It is very easy to put labels on people and put people in a category, or that we live in a culture where you can walk up and down the magazine aisle at the grocery store where there's all sorts of gossip and rumors and scandals about people, and that we can make fun of them and laugh at them and joke at them and Google about them and pass all sorts of, you know, disparaging remarks about them. We can do that with politicians, whether it's local politicians or state-level politicians or national-level politicians, the way that we would talk about them as if they have zero value whatsoever as a human being. To show honor is to treat someone with dignity and kindness, because you recognize that regardless of how you feel about someone in a particular moment, you're talking about someone that God's created and that he loves, and that alone is worthy of showing honor. Honor comes down to what you choose to perceive about someone. Now, I've talked about this before, but it happens pretty much every year when we head into kind of the end of the school year. And inevitably, I find myself running into high school juniors and seniors who are struggling relationally. And typically what they find themselves struggling with is in their parents, or, you know, typically with their moms. And they feel like mom is way too emotional, you know, and feel like mom is overreacting to so many things. And they're like, you know what, I'm 17, I'm 18 years old, or they're maybe ending college, and I'm like 21, I'm 22, and she's treating me like a kid, and it's driving me crazy. And there ends up being this huge strain between kids and their parents, and little, if any, honor ends up getting showed. Even though God makes it pretty clear in the scriptures, he says in the Ten Commandments, honor your father and mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God has given you. But again, we misunderstand honor. We misunderstand what honor is and what honor isn't. But each time I find myself having a similar conversation with people where I'll say, okay, listen, you know, I'll be talking to the student and I'll be like, now this isn't everybody's story, but there's a good chance it's your story where your mom likely wiped your bottom for at least the first couple years of your life, you know? And she made sure you were fed, and she cleaned up your puke, and she provided clothes for you, and she drove you to soccer and to gymnastics and to ballet and to baseball or to football, and she helped you with homework, and she helped keep a roof over your head, and on and on and on. And here's what you need to understand about your mom, that much of her identity the last 18 years has been shaped by being your mom and by doing those things. And right now, she probably feels like that all of that is slipping through her fingers and that all of that is walking out the door. And she's not quite sure how to handle that, because her focus is all on what's being torn from her, what's leaving her, and specifically, who's leaving her. And she's bound to get emotional. But when you're 17 or 18, here's what you got to understand about you. You're focused on all the new things that are ahead of you. You're focused on new independence. You're focused on new experiences. You're reaching out for all these new and exciting things. You're 22 years old. You're about to take on new jobs, a new world, all that. But understand, your mom is experiencing just the opposite. Everything is leaving for her. You're reaching for all sorts of new things, and stuff is getting torn away from her. And so you need to regularly reflect on the incredible vital role your mom has played in your life. And in doing so, you got to figure out, how do I show honor well? And even for no other reason, and this applies to all of us, the fact that your mom and dad played an absolutely essential role in your existence, that without them, without your mom making the decision to carry you in her womb, you wouldn't even be here. And so this isn't about trying to figure out how to get mom and dad to change. It's about changing how you perceive your mom and perceive your dad. And I'll tell them all the time, because that's where honor starts. You have to change your perception about them and choose to remember and to reflect on what is so valuable about them. You see, the principle is just true. And that's how principles work for any relationship. The honor that you give is determined by the amount of value you perceive. And so often when we feel like, well, you know what, they don't deserve honor. They don't deserve to be honored. They don't deserve this. They don't deserve that. And we think that the other person has to change. But what has to change in us is the perception that we choose to allow ourselves to have. Then honor comes. Second principle is this, is that dishonor is often found in the details. dishonor is often found in the details. Because here's what we know. It's a very rare thing that dishonor just suddenly seizes a person in a relationship. It just doesn't come out of the blue. Instead, it's usually a gradual decline in a relationship toward dishonor, where familiarity often becomes the enemy of honor. You see this happen with a spouse. You see it happen with parents, with kids, with a boss, or with employees, where at one time you perceive them with tremendous value, but now they've become quite common and ordinary to you. Or parents, maybe you can relate to this, where you find yourself treating the friends of your kids who come into your house with way more honor and kindness than you do your own actual kids. That their friends could spill something or break something in your house, and you find yourself responding with all sorts of graciousness and all sorts of patience. Oh, honey, that's okay. No big deal. We can get another one. We can clean it up. It's all right. I've been there. I know that. But if your own kids do it, it's this temptation to jump quickly to shame, to jump quickly to rage. And how dare you? Don't you respect our house? Don't you care anything? Don't you pay attention? All this kind of stuff. And what has happened is familiarity has become the great enemy of honor. But the reverse is also true. So students, hear me on this. Some of you students will say please and thank you to your friends' parents and will even kindly engage them in conversations with complete sentences. But somehow, you can only muster up one-word answers or grunts or eye rolls toward your own parents when they try to have a conversation with you. And what has happened is familiarity has become the great enemy of honor. You see, rarely out of the blue does it just become, I don't respect you. Rarely does it out of the blue, it becomes, I have nothing in me that desires to show you honor. It doesn't happen that way. Rather, it's often in the little details that slowly cut away at honor. And it happens when you choose not to guard your own heart and your own perception. It's in the tone of contempt and disappointment in your voice. Regardless of what words do or do not come out of your mouth, week after week, month after month. Because many times when tension happens, we find ourselves arguing about words, what was said or what wasn't said. You said this, or no, I didn't say that, blah, blah, blah. And yet it's the contempt in your voice. It's the way you look at them. It's in your body language that communicates this lack of honor. It's in the sarcastic quips that slowly chip away at conversation after conversation after conversation. It's in the way you talk about your spouse or your kids or your parents to others that you think is in jest, but when they are overheard, they slowly erode confidence that you actually like them. Because here's this insight on family relationship. Many times what people default to in their family relationships is that people are obligated to love them. So they don't question whether or not you love them or not. What they question is whether you actually like them. That is what erodes away at their heart. Whether you value them. It's in the things that you fail to acknowledge in the midst of your busyness that you fail to remember or notice, whether it's a birthday or an anniversary or a day of an important interview or an important test, whatever it is that's important to them that quietly whittles away at honor. Because dishonor, friends, it's found in the little details and it happens slowly over time. It does not come out of the blue. So the challenge becomes to realize that honor is built back up slowly over time in the details. It's a posture of your heart that says, even though we've been married for 20 years, I am going to position my heart and my attitude and my attention toward you as someone who values you, as someone who sees you as important, as worthy of honor that is treasured and that is adored. And I will find a way to make sure I communicate that to you when you walk into a room or when you walk into through the door. It's a posture of the heart that refuses to give your best attention and level of engagement to those at work or at school and then leave those you claim to be the most important to you with only scraps of what's left over of you. Details dishonor. They lead to dishonor slowly over time, but details also continue to build up honor slowly over time. A couple weeks ago, my youngest son, Trace, had asked me to go upstairs and play a basketball video game with him, and I'd gotten home late that day from work because I'd been helping a family through a difficult situation, and so we only had about 30 minutes before his bedtime. So I was sitting on the couch while we were playing, and the game hit a timeout, and so I kind of instinctively just kind of picked up my iPhone, and partly to check to see if there were any updates and what was going on, and then partly just to kind of check email and check out, you know, mentally, and to check Twitter and to check ESPN.com or whatever, just because I've got to, you know, I'm just trying to check my brain out. And my 8-year-old looks over at me, and very kindly and gently he said, "Dad, do you think we could ever play a game sometime together without the iPhone?" Yeah. And he said, it's just the only quality time that we've had together today. And man, it wrecked me. Just wrecked me. And I'm sitting there and I've got all these emotions going on inside of me. And I just looked at him and I said, "Boy, how dare you come after my iPhone?" No. <That's it. laughs> I said, "You know what, buddy? I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. You are absolutely right. I hope you can forgive me. Because you know what? Your dad makes plenty of mistakes too." And I put my phone on the other side of the room and finished the game. And a couple days later, a few of us were sitting together in our offices and we were sharing similar stories about our kids and our distracted selves and these addictions that we had developed to certain things on our phones. And so we just had this really kind of sacred moment, you know, where we grabbed our phones and a couple of us got together on the couch and we're like, "All right, you know, man, this has got to change." And so hit delete, you know, on Facebook or delete on Twitter. And then the big one for me was I shut off access to email on my phone and just switched it off. And yeah, and I want you to know, because I was like, okay, I can, on my laptop, I mean, I have a laptop, and so there's going to be plenty of time. I don't have to access to all the time, and, you know, there's going to be a few times a day when I get on to work on that kind of stuff, and I can do that. But I didn't do it because I think everyone should do that, so please trust my heart on that. It's just with my pace of life, it's this discipline that I found is necessary in my life right now so that I can appropriately honor my family. And it's a detail, it's a small detail, but it's one that I'm hopeful reflects my heart's intent toward them, that communicates my desire to be present and to engage with them, rather than just giving them the leftovers. And so we all have to be reminded, and we can't take for granted, to pay attention to the details, because if we don't pay attention to the details, then we may find ourselves descending into dishonor in different relationships in our life without even realizing it. So we got to pay attention to the details. Third principle is this, is that honor is not something that can be demanded. You can't demand honor. Because when you feel like you're being dishonored, the great temptation is to try to demand it and to present it as something that you're owed or entitled to, where a parent yells or threatens to try to demand honor because they think they're owed that because of their position in the home or because of their authority, or a boss tries to intimidate or bully his employees because, you know, the boss, she's frustrated that they don't get it and they don't get how hard she works and they don't get everything that she has done for everyone in the company and what she's given up. Or in a spouse, it can often not look like intimidation, and sometimes it can, but many times with a spouse, it looks like guilt and manipulation. And you try to guilt people into giving you the honor that you're convinced that you're entitled to. And so you find ways to kind of manipulate that or bring things up, or you kind of seed the conversation so that someone will return honor to you. But it's really about how do I manipulate them to get what I want. But you got to understand, by trying to demand it or require it, you may end up getting compliance or you may get obedience, but it won't feel anything actually like honor. And the same goes with guilt and manipulation. You may get compliance, but it will feel very shallow and empty when you do. And here's what we have to be very careful in ourselves, is that we can easily start to justify this entitlement in our own hearts and justifying our demands and justifying our manipulation, because we start to think, okay, listen, they don't understand how much I've given up for them. They don't understand how hard I've worked for them. They don't understand how much I've sacrificed for them. But here's what we have to wake up to. We have to be keenly aware of this, that an attitude that focuses on what we've sacrificed, when we focus on what we've sacrificed much more than we care to admit, it creates this sense of entitlement. It creates this sense of you owe me kind of attitude, and this hidden sense of superiority that convinces us that we deserve to be honored, that we're entitled to it, that we're owed it. And then so when we don't get it, we can find ourselves trying to manipulate others to get the honor we think we deserve. Or then when we get desperate and our manipulation efforts haven't worked, then we move toward demanding it, screaming for it, yelling for it, intimidating, threatening to get it. And yet, here's what we learn from Jesus, is Jesus didn't ever demand honor. He didn't. He did what ministry he could do there in Nazareth, here in Mark chapter 6, and then he quietly moves on to the next town, not demanding honor. Jesus instead chose to focus on living an honorable life. How do I live with honor? Because again, we can't control other people. We can't control what other people do. We can only control what we do. Now, if you've got someone in your life and you've got people in your life that you feel like are constantly dishonoring you, and you struggle with this great temptation of demanding honor from them, one of the things from this story of Mark 6 that's a good reminder is that Jesus' own family there in his own hometown were part of the crowd that were dishonoring him. In fact, they thought he was crazy. We read that a few weeks ago in Mark, earlier in Mark, where it says that his mother Mary and his siblings came to Jesus to seize him because they thought he was out of his mind. They were trying to take him away. They were convinced he was crazy. And so that same attitude is referenced here when Jesus says in verse 4, only in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor. And among those relatives in his own house who were dishonoring Jesus was his younger brother, whose name was James. Now, imagine James at this point in life was extremely confused and puzzled about this older brother of his. Perhaps he was pretty angry at him for the scandal that was surrounding Jesus and everything he had to listen to from his neighborhood friends about this Jesus. And who knows how many years James spent acting dishonorably toward his brother. But here's what's good to be reminded of. That within 30 years from this point that we read here in Mark chapter 6, James would be known throughout the entire country and eventually throughout the entire world as a man synonymous with being a faithful follower of Christ. A teacher who, that we have the book in the New Testament, James, that he wrote. And a man marked with this intense loyalty to his older brother, Jesus the Messiah. And so again, it's just good to be reminded that God is always working, even when you might not see evidence of it in the moment. And that it's not your job to change people. It's not my job. It's not our job to change people's hearts, but that's God's job. It's his responsibility. And so that instead of demanding honor, you and I are freed to simply seek to live honorably. And that you would seek, as the scriptures say, to honor everyone. Everyone. Regardless if they're placed in a position of authority over you, or they're beside you, or they're placed in a position under your authority, regardless if you agree with them or you approve of their choices, and regardless if they deserve it or not, you choose to live a life that honors people, that places a value on their life, not based on what they've done or haven't done, but based on the value that Christ has already given their life. It says this in the book of Romans, you see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, while we were still bent on selfishness, while we were still screwed up and messed up, Christ died for us. Though we did nothing to deserve it, and though we do nothing to deserve it now, we did nothing to deserve it then, God chooses to love us, to value us, and to honor us, even at our worst. And we're called to show that same kind of honor and that same value to others. So one last thought, and then we'll close. Since honor is this fading art in our culture, it's hard to find a place to where you can learn from it, and you can learn how to do it. But if you want to see honor displayed well, the best place usually is to find it at a funeral. You ever notice that? Because it doesn't matter what someone did or didn't do. It doesn't matter what they deserve, what they didn't deserve. People, time and time again, find a way to make a deliberate choice and decision to find a way to show honor. So my hope is that we'd be a community of people that would learn how to show honor to people long before the funeral happens. That we'd learn how to show honor to everyone. That we'd understand what honor is and we understand what it isn't. And we would find a way to show honor, and that we'd honor them not because we think they deserve it, but rather because of Christ and who Christ says that they are. So let's pray. God, thank you so much for my friends, for this community of people. Thank you for the chance to link arms with them, to stumble with them, and pursue you together. God, I pray that you would continue to teach us about what it looks like to love well. And in that you would teach us what it looks like to show honor. Or we need our perceptions changed of certain people in our life. I pray that you would do that. You would help us to creatively see and to remind ourselves of the value that is in them, and that we would treat them accordingly. And God, I pray that this would be a group of people, this community, this Crosspoint community, that while we don't, we stumble around, we make plenty of mistakes and do all sorts of things, that we would be a community that is known for that we treat people respectfully and we treat them with honor and with dignity, regardless of, what they deserve or don't deserve. I pray that you'd help that to mark us. So we're so grateful for you, so grateful for the life you're inviting us into. And we pray this together in the name of the resurrected Christ. Amen. Thanks, friends. We'll see you next week.